Hello, everybody. Welcome back to New Books in History. My name is Peter Christian Agnew, your host. Today, we're speaking with Brian Purnell about his new book, Fighting Jim Crow in the County of Kings, the Congress of Racial Equality in Brooklyn. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed the book, and anyone that's interested in the new growth field in civil rights history, which is the history of the movement in the North, will be definitely be interested in your book. Why don't you tell us a little bit first about yourself and how you came to the project?
Well, I grew up in New York City, specifically in the Coney Island and Brighton Beach sections of Brooklyn. And I went to undergraduate at Fordham University in the Bronx. I majored in history and African American studies, and I had some really great professors there. A theologian named Mark Chapman, a historian named Claude Mangum, another historian named Irma Watkins Owens, who wrote a really important book on West Indians in New York in the early 20th century called Blood Relations. And I studied a lot with a social historian and a political historian named Mark Nason, who's also a lifelong New Yorker and an activist and a community organizer. And Mark's classes were just electrifying and exciting and really opened my mind up to a lot of things that I was always interested in but never knew about. And he would assign us research papers, and he would assign us these great books and to read in class. And I came across a footnote in one of the books about all of these demonstrations that had occurred in New York City in the 1960s against demonstrations to open jobs in the construction industry for African Americans and Puerto Ricans. And it was just a footnote in the book, and I'd never heard anything about that. I never heard about protests against racism in New York City. I never heard about protests during the 60s, during the civil rights movement outside of the South. So I just followed on that footnote. I really just started doing research in the New York Times as an undergrad, and that's how I started doing this book. I wrote a paper as an undergrad, and that paper turned, I guess, into kind of a senior year thesis as an undergrad. And one thing that Mark Nason encouraged all of his students to do was to do interviews with people. So he encouraged me to call up this activist that he knew in Brooklyn who was involved in the 60s and ask him if I could talk to him about discrimination in the construction trades industry. And as an undergrad, I must have done about three or four interviews. And I just kept working on it in graduate school. And then when I finished my PhD as a new professor, first at Fordham and now at Bowdoin College, I just kept working on it until I published it as a book. But that's how I came to it. It was really just an interest from reading a book and not knowing about something and wanting to learn more.
Right. Well, as I said, we don't think about the North or New York City when we think about the civil rights movement, typically, or at least the public doesn't. I want to actually read your first page because I think it sets up beautifully your story and gets us into these historiographical questions. So I'm going to read this, and then I'd like you to talk a little bit about where your story fits into the literature, the professional literature. You write, on February 3rd, 1964, one of the largest civil rights demonstrations in U.S. history occurred. Nearly 500,000 students boycotted a racially segregated municipal public school system as parents and activists demanded a plan for comprehensive desegregation. 10 years after the Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision had declared racially segregated public schools unconstitutional, this city's government had failed to desegregate the school system. The integration movement rallied behind a Christian minister, a man known for his eloquent, trenchant sermons against racial discrimination and poverty. He transformed his church into a movement headquarters, which organized racially integrated freedom schools, quote unquote, throughout the city. The man and the movement made history. But this minister's name was Milton, not Martin, and his church was in Brooklyn, New York, not Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah.
So I just love the way you set that up, because it captures very rightly this contradiction between the images that we have of the civil rights movement in the popular culture and what historians know and what historians have been writing a lot about recently, which is the movement in the North.
Yeah. So I have, I have my dissertation advisor. His name was Jeffrey Sammons. He's a historian. He teaches at NYU. He actually just wrote co-authored a really good book on the early civil rights movement during World War I. He wrote a really good book on black soldiers from a New York regiment, the 369th. But anyway, one of the things that Dr. Sammons always tried to encourage me to do was to write in such a way that kind of grabbed readers' attentions, doesn't give away the whole story, and maybe kind of intrigues the reader a little bit. So that's what I did in that paragraph. I really wanted to try to play around with what readers already know about the civil rights movement. And I wanted to give them this vague description of a protest movement that occurred in a really big city and that had this really charismatic minister. And then tell the reader that it was New York that we're talking about, or that it was Brooklyn specifically, that we're not talking about the South. And when I wrote the book, there had already begun to be a very, I won't say small, but there had begun to emerge this percolating amount of literature, this kind of percolating interest in civil rights movement activism outside of the South. And there were about maybe half a dozen or so really good books that had come out. Martha Biondi's book, To Stand and Fight, which is about New York City from the mid-40s through the mid-50s. Clarence Taylor's two very good books, one called The Black Churches of Brooklyn, and the other one is a biography of Milton Galamison, a very important minister in Brooklyn, who was an activist in the 60s. Robert Self, in 2003, published a very important book about Oakland. Matthew Countryman, in 2006, published a very good book about civil rights and black power in Philadelphia. And then, of course, in 2003, there's Jean Theo Harris and Kamosi Woodard's co-edited Freedom North, which is a collection of essays about civil rights struggles outside of the South. So there's about, I'd say, half a dozen or so people who are really interested in this question of what did the movement look like outside of the South? What did it look like in local communities? And what were the effects of civil rights activism outside of the South before the late 1960s and before the Black Power movement, which is when most people who are interested in the history of the civil rights movement outside of the South, that's usually when they turn their attention to that theater, so to speak.
Right.
And there's even a way earlier book. It came out in the early 90s, actually, by James Ralph on a book about Martin Luther King in Chicago in 65, 66 and 67. So there was some literature, there were some books, there were some people interested in this question of the movement outside of the South. And it was really just starting to take off as a field. 10 years after Freedom North, so now we have Tom Segrew's very good synthesis kind of overview book of the movement outside of the South called Sweet Land of Liberty. And there's a lot more scholarship about women and radicals and early precursors to Black Power that occur in the late 50s and the 60s, and concentration on civil rights and labor, and a lot of stuff on schools outside of the South. It's really an extraordinary time to be interested in history of the civil rights movement and to be working on it. And I guess I would just say one other thing. I think a lot of the A lot of the energy behind this scholarship came from some really exciting work that Charles Payne and John Dittmer and William Chafe did on the South, which was to raise questions about local communities and local history. So the book that really excited me a great deal when I was a graduate student was Charles Payne's book, I've Got the Light of Freedom, the community organizing tradition in Mississippi. And that is just, it's just a phenomenal, phenomenal book. It's exciting. It's about local people. It's about community people who are involved in civil rights activism in Mississippi way before the 1960s, and their families and their communities and the incredible violence they experience and the importance of women. And I really think that a lot of scholars who work on the North drew inspiration from the scholarship and the books that looked at local communities in the South.
Yeah. Well, your book is, corollary to that. I mean, it's obviously that influence. It's a really good case study of a local group and gets into all of the sort of questions that that raises when you put the magnifying glass on people on the grass at the grassroots level, instead of looking at Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and all these sort of elite figures. And I want to talk more about that later on. I wonder if you could say just one more thing before we move on about how this literature that's coming out now is, for the people that are, not professional historians that are listening in, how, the sort of dynamic that it's working against too, in terms of the narrative we have. You know, you quote Julian Bond, this master narrative that we have about the good and the bad civil rights era, and how we sort of break up this period chronologically, whether we should think about it as a long movement, what that term means, because your book also adds to that and sort of widens our understanding about how to think about the Black freedom struggle.
So Julian Bond, who was a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which was predominantly in the South and it was predominantly college students, he had this line or this idea. I don't know when he articulated it. I first read about it in Charles Payne's book, I've Got the Light of Freedom. Julian Bond had this idea that there was a normative narrative, a master narrative of the civil rights movement's history. And the basic outline of that narrative, a lot of us know, not everybody, but it usually starts sometime in the mid-1950s. We are coming up on an anniversary of an event that we usually associate with the beginning of the civil rights movement, December 1st in 1955, when the Montgomery Police Department in Alabama arrests Rosa Parks for civil disobedience on a public bus. And from December of 1955 through for over a year, through the end of 1956 and into 1957, there's this massive bus boycott, the Montgomery bus boycott. Some people put the starting line of the civil rights movement a little bit earlier, that people look at two other earlier moments. Brown versus Board of Education, May 1954, when the Supreme Court declares that racial segregation is unconstitutional, and the murder of Emmett Till, a young teenager from Chicago who is visiting family in Money, Mississippi in 1955. So there's these moments, there's these three moments in the South that a lot of histories, a lot of synthesis histories or kind of narrative histories of the civil rights movement, that's usually when they start. And it's usually set, the story of the civil rights movement, the master narrative, starts in the mid-1950s. It's set in the South, and it forms around pretty big named people, especially Martin Luther King Jr. In fact, the Rosa Parks story is really unfortunate, because it's often just a preface to introduce King, when in reality, Rosa Parks just has this amazing life and career of her own that moves all over the country. And, you know, Jean Theo Harris's book on the radical Rosa Parks is just an amazing, amazing recent book on how complicated and multifaceted this history is. But this grand narrative, or this master narrative, is usually starts in the South. It centers around people like King. It focuses a lot on Washington, D.C., too, on John F. Kennedy's administration, on national speeches regarding civil rights and the president's response to violence in Birmingham in 1963, on Kennedy's assassination and then Johnson's taking over of the presidency, the passing of major legislation. The master narrative follows these national events, and it focuses on major organizations and major figures. And when you get to the mid-1960s, it becomes a declension narrative. It turns into a story about decline and about factions forming within the movement. And that story about the decline usually involves the rise of the Black Power movement, the frustration and disaffection of young Black people within the movement. And again, because the master narrative focuses on kind of individual personalities, this is when Stokely Carmichael comes to the scene in the national story. And the civil rights movement begins to fall apart and fracture and move in all sorts of different directions. And that's also the time when the North comes into the story. It's the late 1960s. It's Black Power. And the story can then focus on organizations like the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. So, and then the grand narrative ends either there with the infighting between civil rights and Black Power, or it will go to 1968 and end with King's assassination. So there's a lot of really good, exciting, interesting, wonderfully written, and visually captivating material that follows this narrative. The two things that come to mind are the Eyes on the Prize series, which even any revisionist historian would agree that that is a really important source, that documentary series, The Eyes on the Prize. And then there's the Taylor Branch trilogy on America in the King years. So, you know, this master narrative, it does a lot of really interesting and exciting storytelling, but there's some problems with it when you consider that it is so heavily focused on the South. It doesn't bring the North in until much later in the story. And when the North comes in to the master narrative, the North is really this place where the movement goes to die. It's this place where there is no interracial activism. There's no nonviolence. The North is always presented as a place where nonviolence just won't work. And it's this place that's really seen as the antithesis of the civil rights movement. So the North equals Black Power. The South equals civil rights. The South is this place where major legislation, where a movement that passes major legislation, which changes the country, can come into existence. And the North in the grand narrative gives us this muddied, complicated, antagonistic policy of affirmative action. And that's in the grand narrative. The North really becomes an opposite to the South. And I think that the scholarship or the research that I did, and that a lot of other people that I mentioned earlier in the interview has done, has really tried to show that that's wrong. I mean, that's just the wrong way to think about the North. It's the wrong way to think about civil rights activism in America. And maybe more importantly, it's the wrong way to think about the history of racial discrimination in our country. So I think that's what some of the, you know, those are some of the really important interventions or corrections that my book tries to make and that other people who write about the North try to make in their books.
Right. I mean, in this narrative, the North is, you know, a place of racial harmony. And by focusing on people like the Black Panthers and talking about the North only when we get to the late 60s, the sort of effect of this, and scholars have looked at how, you know, political figures, starting in the early 80s, really adopt this narrative for very political ends, right? To essentially counter these movements that are aimed at the de facto segregation that we find in the North, right? And that's where your story begins, right? And this is where all this literature sort of dwells, is this view we have in our mind and the popular impression that the South is a place of de jure Jim Crow, right? And the North is de jure Jim Crow's weak cousin, in Robert Self's, you know, term. You have this great quote from James Baldwin, right? And the attitude of people in the North is, well, we have segregation here, but nobody did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And these movements, what the effect of bringing in these movements that are agitating and challenging segregation in the North in the post-war era and earlier, complicates that narrative, blurs these lines. You know, it throws these neat dividing lines into question. So why don't you give us the lay of the land before the period you investigate. Tell us about Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, and, you know, where is it and what does it look like?
So Bedford-Stuyvesant is this community that sits in kind of literally in the heart of Brooklyn. It's kind of, well, and Brooklyn itself, Brooklyn, New York, or Kings County, New York, is one of the five boroughs of New York City. And it is it was its own city until 1898, when there's a consolidation and a merger of the five counties or five boroughs that become Greater New York City. So Brooklyn has this really interesting culture and character, which even today sees itself as different or separate from Manhattan, especially. I mean, you know, Brooklyn is always considered to be part of New York City, but I think there is some lingering attitude of how Brooklyn could stand apart.
Absolutely.
And had always stood apart for, over 200 years, maybe 250 years as its own place. So in the 20th century, Brooklyn, like a lot of other places, a lot of other cities in the United States, experiences two almost simultaneous social changes and economic changes. One is its manufacturing and in its industrial production expand a great, great deal. And this really happens tremendously around World War II. And the second thing that happens with the addition of the expanding manufacturing and industrial and jobs sector is very large migrations of Southerners, white and black, from in New York's case, from Virginia and the Carolinas and Florida, a little bit from maybe Tennessee or Kentucky, but really from the Eastern Seaboard. There are mass migrations of Southerners and large numbers of African Americans who move to cities all throughout the country, to these emerging industrial and manufacturing arsenals of democracy, Roosevelt called them during the war. So the social demography of Brooklyn is going to change pretty dramatically from the early 1900s until about 1950. The black population in Brooklyn is going to grow in a pretty significant way. And it's not going to stop until the 20th century. I mean, by 1970, Brooklyn has, I think, over, I might get the number a little bit wrong, but by 1970, Brooklyn, I think, has 656,000 black people in Kings County, New York, in Brooklyn, New York. And, you know, that's a, and Bedford-Stuyvesant in 1960 has about 350,000 of those black people are living in Bedford-Stuyvesant, this neighborhood in the middle of central Brooklyn. So if Brooklyn is this pretty large, 70 square mile or so city within the city of New York, Bedford-Stuyvesant is this pretty small, incredibly overcrowded, overwhelmingly black city within the city of Brooklyn. And it's also a magnet for immigrants from the Anglophone West Indies, Barbados, Jamaica, Trinidad. And it's also drawing people from Puerto Rico at this time, too. So when black people are moving to Brooklyn or to New York City, there are very few places where they can live. And this is where that idea that you were talking about, the de jure and the de facto segregation, becomes really a useless idea. There's, to divide American segregation between saying that in a place like Mississippi or Alabama, racism is real because it's part of the law, that by law you can have black and white people separate in everything in Mississippi. But in New York, there is no law that says that blacks and whites have to be separate. And now that's true. I mean, that is a fact. In fact, New York is the first state to pass anti-discrimination law in employment in 1945. It's the first state to outlaw racial discrimination in employment. It becomes the first state to outlaw racial discrimination in the private housing market as well. But here's the irony. It doesn't matter, right? And that's one of the powerful ironies about racial discrimination in the North, or in a place like New York. You don't need to have laws segregating black people in certain housing and in certain schools and in certain businesses or in certain jobs. You don't need those laws because people do it anyway. Right. And so what we see in New York by 1960 is you have hundreds of thousands of black people congested and crowded into an area of Brooklyn that has very old housing stock that's bursting at the seams, that you have people who are able to move into the World War II job economy, and then very quickly, with the recession that follows the war, they're the first fired out of those manufacturing jobs. They're living in a city that's beginning to go through changes in which it's losing its manufacturing and its industrial base. The Brooklyn Navy Yard slowly begins to close its doors in the early 1960s. 1964, there's big downscaling of work at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And by 1966, the Navy Yard's gone.
Yeah, I think between 1952 and 1960, the state as a whole loses more than 250,000 jobs in manufacturing.
So the newcomers are the hardest hit by this, and black newcomers are hit particularly hard because they don't have the freedom to move anywhere they want to move. They're limited in their housing choices. They're limited to black ghettos. Their schools are, the schools of their children are becoming way overcrowded and way under-resourced. And the state is not addressing those issues as issues that stem from patterns of segregation. The laws that exist to deal with racial discrimination are weak and ineffective at best, because they rely on moral suasion rather than relying on a judicial process and an adjudication process that makes it undesirable to discriminate. And all of these things are happening at a time when African American population is surging in New York, when white population is declining. By 1980, Brooklyn loses about a million white residents who are able to move to other parts of the city, or who are really able to move into outlying suburbs. And all of these patterns are happening by the mid 20th century, by the early 1960s. And that's the world that Brooklyn Core steps into when it comes into existence in 1960. And those are going to be the types of problems, the types of political and social problems that this interracial chapter of activists tries to change.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the other thing is that New York leads the country because of, you know, Robert Moses, the state parks commissioner, leads the country in road building. And these highways, as you said, you know, take all these mostly middle class white residents in Brooklyn and other areas out to the suburbs. At the same time that the city is busily demolishing neighborhoods through urban renewal and replacing those jobs in manufacturing with, you know, knocking down the slaughterhouses around the UN, putting up the UN and knocking down all these neighborhoods and putting in commercial high rises and luxury apartments and replacing the old working class jobs that people were coming north for with finance and big law firms and the like. And then at the same time, the South continues to throw out millions of people because these big planters are taking advantage of these New Deal loans and automating.
Yep.
And this is a, you know, really important backdrop. I mean, your quotes earlier about, you know, it's 1940, you say there's 107,000 blacks in Brooklyn. And I had the same number you did, 1970, 656,000. It's a huge, huge increase. And the similar things going on in Harlem and other black enclaves. And so we have this deindustrializing city. And, you know, there's this myth that's grown up. I think anyone that's grown up in the suburbs around the city like I did has heard this, you know, about old New York and how, you know, it's when the blacks come that it all goes to pot.
Right.
Instead of looking at it in terms of a structural phenomenon, I want to read. There's a quote. You have all these letters that come in from white Brooklyn residents to the Brooklyn Core. There's this letter here on page 109. Since the colored people came to Brooklyn, we have rape, muggings, and robberies. It is up to you and your race to get after this type of hoodlum and help us so we can have Brooklyn as in years gone by. Teach them not to be horrid white haters. They only go to their shops. They only hire colored taxi drivers, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes on. And you begin the story by talking about these quotes from Pete Hamill and Mark Elliott talking about old Brooklyn and, you know, how it was the place that it was the kind of place that America fought for in World War II, where, quote, you know, everyone had the right to work, live, play alongside their fellow man, regardless of race or creed. And then you contrast it rather beautifully, I think, with this story of John Hope Franklin, right, the famous historian, right, who tries to buy a home in all white Flatbush when he gets accepted to Brooklyn College, which, you know, is such a noteworthy event in itself. The New York Times puts it on the front page.
Right.
And he can't get in anywhere. He has to finally rely on a white colleague to buy a home.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Brooklyn, it has this really mythical, very romantic image in American's imagination of the mid 20th century. And there's a great line. There's a great idea. I'm blanking a bit on his name. I think it's Peter Novick. That might be wrong, but there's a journalist. There's a very well-known journalist.
Pete Hamill?
No, it wasn't Pete Hamill. And he grew up in Brooklyn. This guy grew up in Brooklyn, and he goes through all the different ideas of the romantic image of Brooklyn in the mid-20th century. And he says something like, for all of this togetherness that we had in Brooklyn, there was a lot of separation. And it was one of the only ideas I found from a popular writer talking about the romantic image of Brooklyn in the 1940s and 50s that said, you know, that there was a lot of separation and segregation, and for poor people, a lot of misery in Brooklyn. So you know, you have in the 1940s when there is this change, this population change coming to Brooklyn in the form of Black newcomers, Puerto Ricans, and lots of people coming to seek work in the wartime industry. In the post-war period, there's the story of Jackie Robinson and the integration of Major League Baseball. And there is this idea, and I don't want to say that it's not true, because every myth in some way is built upon some truths, or at least some ideas about truth.
Right.
New York City in general, and Brooklyn in particular, it is possible to be a blue collar working class person and have, if you're white, you can have options for lots of different types of housing. And even if you're not white and you're circumscribed to a particular area, it's still in the post-war period, because there's explosions in the constructions of public housing during the Great Depression, and because New York City is just constantly a magnet for people, you know, people are able, working people and blue collar people are able to live in ways that are harder for them to do in either the rural communities that they came from, their European homelands, the islands in the Caribbean where they came from. There is opportunity in New York. The problem with this romantic myth about Brooklyn, which is all about, you know, drinking egg creams and playing stickball, and about how everybody rooted for Jackie Robinson, is that it leaves absolutely no room for Franklin, John Hope Franklin's story. And John Hope Franklin's story, like you briefly mentioned, is that you have this nationally, you know, nationally known figure, this somewhat of a celebrity academic. I mean, he's the first Black historian to chair the history department at an all-white university, which is Brooklyn College at the time, 1963. And it makes the front page of the New York Times. But like you said, and like I wrote about in the book, he can't buy a house wherever he wants in Brooklyn. His mortgage lending agency, the real estate agency, both places try to steer him out of homes around Brooklyn College's campuses, which are predominantly white areas at the time. So the problem with the myth of the romantic era of Brooklyn's history is one, that it leaves out the very real history of racial segregation and racism. And two, it sets up this other story, which you alluded to, which is that when Brooklyn and New York start to experience some serious social and political problems, because the city is getting overcrowded, because the city is not dealing well with inequality, resource inequality with things like sanitation or public schools, because neighborhoods are becoming overcrowded, because poverty levels are increasing amongst poor, predominantly Black people in the city. When you have all these things start to happen, people, especially white New Yorkers, especially people who left the city, immediately begin to identify the reason for these social problems as the culture and the behavior of the newcomers, right? It becomes a very easy, simple, powerful idea to blame excessive trash, failing schools, high crime rates, all of these social problems that Brooklyn and other cities and New York begin to experience. Becomes very easy to blame that on the behavior and culture of the people who are now living in those areas.
Right. Instead of thinking about the industrial and the capital flight that, that you know, creates the situation.
Right.
Well, so I, maybe this is a good place to start talking about Brooklyn Core and what they're doing, because this is some of the first things that they can evolve with. And this is, you know, in the early 60s. So it's 15 years after, right, Franklin's story. And the New York has just passed the Fair Housing Practices Law, you know, which sets up a federal model. It's the first state law to ban discrimination in the private housing market. Yet, you know, 10 years earlier, as you note, the Supreme Court outlaws the racial covenants that we see in suburbs around the country. And this does nothing to prevent, you know, the suburbs from basically remaining 100% white, more or less. So the Core really gets to start by trying to do the painstaking, difficult work of going about and getting information and trying to solve at the individual level these cases of housing discrimination, right, which are so important to.
Right. Yeah. The first major issue that Brooklyn Core tackles is housing discrimination. And I think that that's for a couple of reasons. It's, you know, Brooklyn, the Brooklyn chapter of Core kind of sets up a desk in an office in the middle of Bedford-Stuyvesant. And they really just, they start by just tackling the issues that people bring to them. And the one issue that people bring to them over and over and over and over again in 1961, is that they tried to rent an apartment outside of Bedford-Stuyvesant, and they saw the apartment advertised in the newspaper or in a sign in the window. And when they went to inquire about renting the apartment, suddenly the apartment was no longer available. And this happens so many times to certain individuals that they suspect that landlords and realtors are discriminating against them because they're Black. So they bring that issue to Brooklyn Core, and Brooklyn Core initiates a pretty traditional protest movement, or a pretty traditional demonstration movement, which is called sandwich testing. I don't know where that term came from, but the sandwich testing method would be when a Black person suspects that they are discriminated against in housing, the activist organization, in this case Brooklyn Core, will send a white couple or a white tester, they called them, to inquire about renting that apartment. And they would always make the white individual or the white couple. So if a Black person is discriminated against, suspects discrimination, they would send a Black person. If it was a married couple, they would send a married couple. They would always make the white testers a little bit less desirable than the actual Black candidate. So they would have the white testers make less money. They would have them have more children. They might even have a white tester as a woman be a single mother, whereas the Black the black woman who wants the apartment is married, and so on. They would have all sorts of ways to see if there was racial discrimination at work in this particular, in this case. And that's how they would uncover individual instances of racial discrimination. Then they would move in to try to shame or intimidate the landlord or the realtor into renting the apartment to the original black applicant. They would threaten to bring them before the New York State Commission Against Discrimination. They would threaten to protest and picket and embarrass the individual landlord. And on a piecemeal basis, Brooklyn Core was able to get some individuals and some families better housing outside of the black ghetto in Brooklyn. What's interesting that I found in the book is that they try to attack the problem of racial discrimination on a much bigger scale than just one-on-one individual cases. They try to attack racial discrimination beyond a case-by-case basis, and they're not successful. They're not successful in overturning what they find through their research to be a major instance of housing discrimination at one of the city's largest housing conglomerates, the Left Rack Corporation. They uncover that Left Rack buildings have discriminatory language in their advertisements. It's not as blatant as saying no coloreds allowed, but the Left Rack Corporation will advertise for its luxury apartments and executive apartments and just a lot of coded language that they did not want black middle class families even to try to move in there. But when black families that did have the money tried to move into some of these Left Rack buildings, they were immediately told that there were no apartments available. And this was a systematic practice. It happened over and over and over and over again. But Brooklyn Core was unable to mount a successful demonstration against that huge housing conglomerate. So on an individual case-by-case basis, they had success. When they tried to attack a system-wide or a city-wide perpetrator of racial discrimination, it's much harder for them to attain a tangible victory.
Well, it's a small organization, and they're, you talk about how they're constantly struggling with the obstacles they face as a small, you know, organization that's desperately in need of manpower and capital, which is not distinct, I think, to Brooklyn Core. We forget that, you know, even Martin Luther King's organization was constantly struggling with money. But this experience, you say, made the group very tight-knit and encouraged them to want to do more, right, to think bigger. And this goes to Operation Unemployment and the battle to desegregate the schools. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Yeah. So the housing case is really, like you said, it brings this small about, you know, there's the numbers of Brooklyn Core change. It's a fiercely democratic organization. Basically, if you show up to meetings, you can be a member of the organization. There's no, you know, there's no, they don't really have a screening process or a probationary period. It's a very, very democratic group. Everybody has a say. There is an executive council of leaders on the group, but it's, you know, I would say 24 members and maybe 10 or so smaller executive leaders of the group. The housing discrimination does bring them together. And one of the fascinating things that I write about in the book is how is that that's not easy. It's not easy to have a successful interracial group. And Brooklyn Core, as small as it is incredibly diverse. There's people of different religions, people of different working or class backgrounds. There's people of different races. There's conservatives and there's communists. It's not like everybody in this organization thinks the same way. So creating camaraderie and creating an effective activist community requires work. and the housing campaigns achieve that. And Brooklyn Core then moves into looking at employment issues and looking at school issues. So the biggest employment issue that they first try to tackle has to do with a local industry, the Evangers Baking Company. And they mount a pretty successful boycott campaign with a small group of ministers like Milton Galamison and with political community organizers like the Unity Democratic Club, which is a kind of insurgent democratic black political club headed by a lawyer named Thomas Russell Jones and Andrew Cooper. And as a side story, that's the organization that makes it possible for, one, the creation of a congressional district in Brooklyn in 1965, 1966, and then two, the eventual black Congress representative who comes out of that club becomes the Congress representative from the 12th CD, and that's Shirley Chisholm. So anyway, Operation Unemployment, which tackles racial discrimination at a local industry, the Ebinger's Baking Company, brings together Brooklyn Core, ministers, the UDC. It's a very grassroots movement. It's a very successful boycott. And, you know, Brooklyn Core wins a spot at the negotiating table to achieve what today we would call affirmative action. They didn't call it that then, but that was one of their demands. One of their demands was that 3 out of 5 employees at the Ebinger's Baking Company, 3 out of 5 new employees be African-American. And prior to this movement, you know, Ebinger's, again, I won't go into too much detail, but Ebinger's was a pretty significant local industry. It had retail outlets all throughout Brooklyn and Queens and some in Staten Island. It had baking plants in Brooklyn. It had distribution depots in Brooklyn, a fleet of shipping trucks that brought the baked goods all throughout the city. I mean, it's one of these local, you know, if you're a local business, a local thriving business in New York City in the 20th century, it's almost like you're similar to being a small corporation in other places, because you have this huge market of over 8 million people. So Ebinger's, you know, I don't want to make it sound like this was just a mom and pop baking store. Like this was
right.
It was a huge, huge industry, and it was based in Brooklyn, and it didn't hire black people to do much besides janitorial work. And a lot of its retail outlets are located in places like Bedford-Stuyvesant, like parts of East Flatbush, like parts of Crown Heights. It's located in places that are becoming more and more populated with black people, and they're not hiring black workers. So this protest movement is effective because Brooklyn Core gets a seat at the negotiating table, and Ebinger's agrees. They agree to hire more black workers. You know, the way that story ends is a bit of a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, Ebinger's closes in the 1970s. So again, it's one of these two step forward, in some ways, 2.5 steps back with respects to what the civil rights movement is able to achieve. And the chapter that I write on public education, desegregating public schools in Brooklyn, is this really, it's a story that is both hopeful and uplifting because of how much energy and how much involvement there is around the issue of African-American families fighting for their children to have better access to good schools in their neighborhoods. It's an incredible story about Brooklyn Core rallying around one of its members, the Beebled family, and rallying around them to try to fight to get better schooling for their children. And it's also this really tragic and sad story that is very much a story of the last 60 years of public education in places like Brooklyn and New York, which is that low-income people and racial and ethnic minorities who are stuck living in places with other low-income people that don't receive adequate services, the schools are just left for dead, basically. And those students are left behind. And that's kind of the sad part of the story of the Brooklyn Core protest to desegregate the schools in Brooklyn, because there's all of this tremendous energy and there's all this tremendous momentum, but the only thing that it's able to accomplish is it's able to allow that one family to improve their children's educational options. And it really does nothing to address the resource inequality that Brooklyn Core argues is at the heart of public school segregation in Brooklyn. There's not enough books. It's overcrowded. Even when the schools are brand new, they're built in areas that funnel 2/3 of the population to be Black and Puerto Rican. And again, 2/3 of that population are going to bring all of the needs that low-income kids are bringing when their parents are struggling to find work, when they have unstable housing choices, and when they have inadequate access to food and healthcare, and that's all going to center into the school. So even, you know, there's questions about the physical facilities of schools in predominantly Black neighborhoods, how it's crumbling and they're old and they're outdated. But you know, there's also brand new schools in the 1960s that are suffering from the effects of racial segregation in public education. And in Brooklyn Core's demonstration, they're able to raise awareness, they're able to raise attention, they're able to help one family. They're not able to turn that situation around. And that's been an ongoing story for the past 60 years or more.
Right. Well, this is also, again, I mean, taking place within the period where, you know, the city is deindustrializing, it's losing its middle class. It's becoming very much a city of the very rich and the very poor. I would think that most people also have very little memory at all. It's not written about much, but the parents and taxpayer movement that organized against the desegregation forces in the city was huge. And the leader, Rosemary Gunning, ran with Buckley in his mayoral and his very, you know, it's electrifying mayoral candidacy in 1965. So we have this year when there's all this federally, there's all this civil rights legislation happening. And in New York City, which is, you know, in some ways a sort of organizational headquarter for a lot of these groups, it's a major source of funding for King's organization and other organizations. And yet, as you say, there's this stalling out because of these structural things, and also because of the difficulty of getting past de facto segregation.
Right.
Well, I wish we had more time to talk about some of the other things in your book, but I think we've taken up a lot of your time already. I want to thank you for being on the show. It was a pleasure reading your book. Why don't you take us out by telling us about what you're working on now?
Well, again, you know, again, thanks for having me. To the listeners who participated in this, thank you for your time. If you do pick up my book, Fighting Jim Crow in the County of Kings, I'd love, you can email me. You can find me on the web. I'd love to hear what you think. But, you know, right now I'm working on two different books. One of them is an oral history or biography of that. If you remember earlier in the interview, I said that I interviewed this activist. The first person that I interviewed, his name is G2 Weyusi. The first time I interviewed him was in 2000. And then in 2005, we started doing a series of interviews about his life. And we did that for 4 years. And G2 Weyusi emerged as this very important figure during the community control movement in 1967, 1968, 1969. In the Ocean Hill Brownsville section of Brooklyn. He became a really influential Black nationalist organizer in Brooklyn. And so I spent 4 years doing interviews with him about his life, all of it, almost all of it, which he spent in Brooklyn. So I'm putting those interviews together as an autobiography narrative in his voice. And I'm also writing a larger history of ghettos in American cities in the 20th century and the ways that ghettos come into existence. And then I focus in that second book on the ghetto, on how in the late 1960s and 1970s, how people worked very hard to unmake ghettos. There's a tremendous amount of energy from all different sectors of American life directed at transforming ghettos. And then the end of the book talks about what happens to ghettos in the late 20th century and the present. So that the name of that book is Unmaking Ghettos. Those are the two things that I'm working on right now.
Sounds fascinating.
Yeah, thanks. I hope maybe we could do this again when one of them comes out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Brian, thanks so much again for being with us.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Thank you for having me. And thanks for the work you do on this show.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. All right. Bye, Brian.
Bye.